Welcome to our latest Bennett Institute podcast. My name is Mike Kenny, and I'm the director of the Bennett Institute for Public Policy, based at the University of Cambridge in the UK. In this episode, we're going to talk about a new report the Institute has just published called Union at the Crossroads, which offers a historical perspective on how Westminster and Whitehall have dealt with devolution. This comes at a time when the future of the UK's internal union looks increasingly perilous, and when questions are being posed about what needs to be done by central government to shore up the union. With me today to answer these questions and more is Philip Roycroft, who joined the Institute 2 years ago and is one of the authors of this report, along with me and Jack Sheldon. Philip has had a long and distinguished career as a civil servant, culminating in his appointment as Permanent Secretary to the Department for Exiting the European Union from 2017 to 19. He has a deep knowledge of the mechanics and dynamics of devolution and played a key role in British government in the run-up to the Scottish referendum campaign in September 2014. Let's start by talking about where things are right now. How likely is it, do you think, that Britain could break apart in the next few years?
Nothing is inevitable, Mike, but we are in what I think is a parlous situation for the union. It is worrying for those who would wish to see the union sustained. If you look what's happening in Scotland, 50% or so of people regularly recording in the polls over the last year or so essentially want to withhold their consent to what they see as a voluntary union. So Scotland is split down the middle. Half the people want in Scotland to leave the UK. We know about the situation in Northern Ireland post-Brexit with the Northern Ireland Protocol. Some huge uncertainties there about whether Northern Ireland. And in Wales, driven again by Brexit, there are an increasing number of people who would put themselves in the so-called indecurious camp. And there is no sign, certainly not in Scotland, of what you might call a Quebec-style reversion to support for the union. The demographics of support for independence work for the nationalists. A very high number of young people say that they would vote for independence. It's only in the older age group, particularly the 75-plus, that you see very solid support for the union. And there is no doubt at all that the whole Brexit has exacerbated these risks. When two parts of a four-part union voted to stay in the EU, but were taken out because of the support for exit in the biggest part of the UK, namely in England, but also in Wales, that was bound to cause stresses and strains. And seen from a longer-term perspective, the emotional resonance of Britishness has been fading for some time. And it's difficult from where we're sitting to see how that is going to be replenished.
You've mentioned some of the different countries that are involved, the different territories that are involved here, and that where devolution has been introduced. I mean, one of the things we were trying to do, I think, in this report was to think about the centre, to think about the role of central government in relation to all this, and particularly in relation to devolution, which we'll come on to. What's your general feeling about how British government has gone about building its relationship with these other devolved governments?
The creation of devolution back in the late 90s, there was put in place a system of intergovernmental relations which sought to manage relations between the four governments of the United Kingdom. But as our work has illustrated, really beyond doubt, those arrangements were really not taken that seriously. The so-called Joint Ministerial Committee didn't meet that often in the early years. And by the time we get to the sort of shockwave of Brexit and COVID, those institutions really couldn't carry the weight that was put upon them. So the UK government really never sat back and thought about how it could manage these relationships over time in order to sustain the sense that the interests of the devolved parts of the UK were being reflected in the very highest councils of the land in Whitehall and in Westminster. that gap in the way in which devolution had been organised was rather brutally revealed by the stresses and strains, notably of Brexit.
So on that question about what kind of machinery might have been built, what would have been more robust than the structures that are put in place after devolution, the counter-argument to our view, which is that, you know, more could have been done on that front, isn't the counter-argument to say, well, look, with the election of an SNP government and its pursuit of the independence cause, this was a government that was never going to play ball. You know, however good the machinery for bringing together those different governments was, this was always going to be a really difficult phase. I mean, is that an important argument to take seriously?
Yes, it is. And the sort of so-called incongruity across the administrations, of course, has had a part to play in this. In the early days, you had Labour-led governments in London, in Cardiff, in Edinburgh, and clearly there was a lot of informal interchange between politicians through that time, and disputes and issues tended to be resolved on the political network without recourse to more formal intergovernmental machinery. With the advent of a minority SNP government in 2007, that of course posed a challenge to this whole set of arrangements. You've also had, in the power-sharing arrangements in Northern Ireland, a political party in Sinn Féin that is not committed to sustaining the union of the United Kingdom. And so they've never been particularly enamoured of United Kingdom structures like the Joint Ministerial Committee. So there was always going to be stresses and strains because of that, those political differences. The challenge, in a way, to the UK government has always been to be able to demonstrate that despite those political differences, it is listening to and comprehending the interests of the different parts of the UK and taking that into account in the way that it makes decisions. A very oppositionalist stance will be reflected in the way that people perceive the way in which the UK government is approaching their interests in Scotland, Wales or Northern Ireland. So, in my view, it's always been important that the UK government gets this right. And it is, the responsibility is a lot greater on the UK government because it is, as it says on the tin, the government for the whole of the United Kingdom. So it has an obligation, in my view, to seek to ride above the political differences so that it can demonstrate it works on behalf of all the people of the United Kingdom.
It's been said a number of times since these reforms were introduced that the British government somehow devolved and then forgot. The government didn't sort of remain closely involved in developments in these other parts of the UK, and that it somehow assumed that these new legislatures would kind of get on with their responsibilities and that those issues had sort of washed off the table, if you like, of the centre. Do you think that's right?
I do think it's right. It's an interesting question. Actually, the roots of that run quite deep. There has been no real tradition in the UK government of engaging with the politics of the territories of the United Kingdom. Don't forget, pre-devolution, most Scottish issues were handled through the Scottish office. It was a department of the UK government, but based mainly in Edinburgh, likewise for the Wales office and the Northern Ireland office. So in terms of education, of healthcare, and a whole range of other policy issues, much of that was dealt with effectively by these territorial departments. So when you add legislative responsibility to those, that administrative devolution, it didn't actually require Whitehall to change very much. The overall sense in Whitehall that was Scotland and Wales had got what they needed. The Labour governments had met the political demand for devolution. There was quite a sharp delineation in most areas between reserved responsibilities and devolved responsibilities. So devolve and forget, sad as it sounds, was really, in many ways, quite rational.
It's really interesting, isn't it, to think about the really marked differences between the way in which the UK goes about decentralising power within it and governance within it, and think about other countries with that are fully federal or have more federal models. One of the things I think that we began to talk about in the paper, to an extent that slightly surprised me actually, was there was also a difference in terms of culture, as well as these institutional features that you've pointed out, that somehow the culture of Whitehall in particular just didn't change that much over time, despite these pretty significant reforms. Can you just talk to us a bit about that, about what you think lies behind that conservatism and perhaps even complacency when it came to devolution?
It's an interesting issue. You know, why wasn't Whitehall in particular more responsive to what was going on as the power relationships within the United Kingdom changed very fundamentally? There wasn't that long tradition in the UK of, if you like, territorial politics being embedded in thinking in Whitehall. And for many departments, devolution was a sort of signal that they could put the affairs of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland even further down their list of priorities. So this was very deeply culturally ingrained in Whitehall and in many ways remains so. The cost of getting things wrong around devolved issues were, for most Whitehall departments, was really seen as somebody else's problem. The way that Whitehall is constructed, the incentives for civil servants and for ministers largely are aligned to their own department. So it was left to the centre, and the centre in Whitehall terms is quite small, to do the worrying about the integrity of the union. And thinking about the territorial settlement is just not in the bloodstream in a way that it is in countries like Spain or Canada. I had the job running the UK governance group of trying to improve understanding across Whitehall of devolution. And we made some progress, but it was uphill work. We got every department to produce a devolution plan. UK government departments are very good at producing plans. Sometimes they're less good at implementing them. Frankly, we did not get far enough for Whitehall to be in a position to cope with the shock that came with Brexit and the way that that destabilised relationships between the governments of the United Kingdom.
As we show in the paper, there are a number of different attempts in recent years to try and get the sort of institutions of state, I suppose, a bit more focused on these issues. Can I just ask you one direct follow-up on that? When you were doing that work, what frustrated you most?
I think it was ultimately an attitudinal thing, that this stuff just wasn't important. And there were other things that Whitehall should be preoccupied about. I mean, of course, there was a deep, deep complacency there, a sense that the United Kingdom was here for keeps. There was nothing that was going to threaten it. So why devote valuable thinking time, policy time, to worrying about something that was some distance from the priorities you would have for your own department? So I found that extraordinarily frustrating because, you know, I had a job to do to make people understand that if the UK government didn't get this right, it risked exacerbating all of those trends which were driving people towards support for independence, particularly in Scotland, but we're seeing also increasingly in Wales. And, you know, Northern Ireland, you have a long-term trend increasing support for unification. Not there yet by any means, but that appears to be the direction of travel. So there was no real emotional engagement with this, no sense that this was everybody's job. The way I used to talk about it to my colleagues, saying that if you think about the pyramid of loyalties in Whitehall, the first loyalty is to your department, the Department of State you work in. The second loyalty, interestingly, quite a long way distant, would be to the government of the day and what that government was hoping to achieve. And thirdly, but really almost out of sight altogether, was that sense of loyalty to the United Kingdom as a political entity. And you can see in other policies that this would be completely inverted, where governments worry about their territorial integrity in a way that puts that very much much at the top of the list of things that they're concerned about.
One of the really striking things in British politics is that devolution is not really itself a topic. It's not a subject that people get worked up about. There's some debate about some of the different changes to those settlements that you've described. But now, in the most recent period, since Brexit, that's begun to change. And there is now an increasing sense, particularly in the Conservative Party and in parts of government, that fundamental aspects of devolution might deserve criticism and perhaps even might be merit changing. Why do you think that's begun to happen now?
Again, it's an interesting issue and reflective of the strains that have come through Brexit, and then many folk in and around the governments in London sort of working out through the COVID crisis just how extensive devolved powers were. So there was in a slightly odd sort of way, COVID was a forced learning exercise for the government in Whitehall and for a lot of folk in Westminster who sort of woke up, perhaps some of them for the first time, to the extent of devolved powers. And I think having seen all of that and seen the rise of nationalism, particularly in Scotland, there is a strain of thinking, particularly, not exclusively, but particularly in the Conservative Party, that devolution is somehow responsible for the rise of nationalism. That diagnosis, in my view, is flawed. I mean, it is clear, of course, that devolution didn't kill off nationalism, as some people hoped in the early days. But I think if you step back from this and look at the reasons why people are supporting independence, the sort of wellsprings of nationalist sentiment run a lot deeper than that. And this is about deeper secular changes to the way that people think about their place in the world, the way they perceive the place of Britain in the world. And it is worth asking these folk the counterfactuals. So are they saying that the Labour government should never have conceded devolution in the late 90s? Let's not forget, there was a very, very powerful drive for devolution, and politicians could claim with some justification that it was the settled will of the people of Scotland. So if devolution had been refused at that time, what impact would that have had on thinking in Scotland? It would hardly, it seems to me, have endeared people in Scotland to the Union and would have created perhaps unmanageable pressure on it. Another dimension of this was the UK government didn't give itself the chance to spend money in devolved areas of policy. Contrast actually quite a lot of federal policies. So if you go to Australia, for example, the federal government can spend money on what we would think of as devolved issues, which helps to build up a partnership with the devolved entities of the states and the provinces, which could have operated in a UK context. But and the current government, UK government, has now given itself powers to spend money in devolved areas, but very, very late in the day. And there's a risk now that that will be done not so much in a collaborative way, but in a more oppositionalistic way, which, again, is hardly likely to engender support for the Union.
And that culture you describe, by and large, survives the shock of the Scottish independence referendum campaign. And towards the end of that, as we talk about in the paper, things get pretty fraught on the Unionist side. From your perspective, you were pretty involved in that period. What did you feel about the way in which the argument for the Union was being made? Did you have any reservations about that, or did you think that it in some ways highlighted some of the difficulties in making the Unionist case?
It was a difficult time because nobody had ever faced a situation like this before. Absolutely unprecedented, where you had two governments within the United Kingdom, both legitimately elected, taking different sides on this existential issue. It drew the civil service, both in Scotland and in London, into this debate while preserving our impartiality. We, of course, had to support the interests of the governments that we worked for, and this was territory nobody had gone into before. And what we discovered, certainly at the UK level, was that there was no pre-existing narrative about the benefits of the United Kingdom. So we basically had to write that up on the hoof as we went through this campaign. So that was, I think, a well worthwhile exercise. It was a justified exercise. It has been caricatured subsequently as Project Fear, that this is all about the negatives of independence. But actually, if you go back to the source material and the way that was presented, the emphasis was on the benefits. This is what you get from being part of the United Kingdom. Though, of course, in the way that it was presented and the way it was reported, people would very often pick up on the negative side of that. Is this is what you lose if you come out of the UK. So you wouldn't be able to keep the currency, the pound. You'd lose aspects of the collaboration on defence policy and so on and so forth. We had to learn as we went along.
In the immediate aftermath of the campaign, as we show in the report, that there are a number of different moves made by the Cameron government which develop devolution or move in the tracks of the model of devolution that Labour had introduced. So you see through the Smith Commission in Scotland, then you see the work on the Wales, leading up to the Wales Act, and then also English Votes for English Laws, the first time there's been a serious attempt to do anything in constitutional terms about sort of English level representation. Had Brexit not come along so soon after those initiatives, what do you think would have happened? Do you think the union might actually have stabilised on a slightly different footing?
That's a great counterfactual to think about it. And there was a deliberate design in both the Scotland and the Wales Act to think about what this would mean for the constitutional debate in Scotland and in Wales. So the devolution of substantial tax-raising powers, and in the case of Scotland, welfare powers, was an endeavour to shift the terms of debate. So the Scottish Government, for example, had complained long and bitterly around the welfare reforms that had led to the so-called bedroom tax. So, fine, we will devolve sufficient powers over welfare and sufficient powers over tax raising for you as a parliament and a government to address those issues as you see, as you think fit. And there were some signs in the May 2016 elections to Scottish Parliament that that was beginning to bite, that the agenda was shifting off constitutional issues and was focusing more on domestic policy around tax, around welfare, around other domestic policies. But we really didn't get long enough with that experiment running before it was all blown out the water by the outcome of the EU referendum. And immediately, everything shifted onto a very different plane. The way things were at that moment and where support for independence was, there was no signs that there was an inevitability of a building up of a head of steam around independence. We were not worrying that after the 2014 referendum that we'd be back into referendum territory anytime soon.
And it's made this question about how the central government relates to these other devolved administrations really central. And I suppose it's also really illuminated this question about, on a matter of statewide interest, who gets their say? And does it matter that Scotland and Northern Ireland have voted in the other direction? A lot seems to have changed because of Brexit. Is that your sense of it, that Brexit has almost changed the game here?
No doubt. Brexit has been transformational. For one thing, it broke one of the central premises of the offer made by the pro-union side in 2014, which was, ironically, as it turns out, that voting no, i.e. staying in the UK, was the only way of securing Scotland's future in the EU. Also, the whole Brexit process, as you say, Mike, revealed pretty harshly how power works in the context of the UK constitutional settlement. So the majority in England vote in one way, it was their will that prevailed. And when we see the disputes over the Brexit legislation, the withdrawal bill became the Withdrawal Act, it demonstrated that the so-called Sewell Convention, that is the obligation on the UK government to seek consent of the devolved legislatures for legislation that impacts on devolved responsibilities, was just that, a convention with no legal or binding force. So Brexit in different ways has rocked relations between in all devolved parts of the UK and between them. Very, very self-evidently, it's put Northern Ireland in this extraordinarily difficult place because of the issue of the border and the absolutely right determination on many sides of the argument to avoid a hard border on the island of Ireland itself. In Scotland, the Scottish government have consistently claimed since the referendum that Scotland has been taken out of the EU against its will. And in Wales, although Wales voted for Brexit, the Welsh government has clearly set its face against the hard Brexit, which the UK government, particularly this UK government, has pursued. The pollsters, I think, will say with some certainty that this whole thing has been responsible for that uptick in support for independence in Scotland, to take it up to and over the 50% mark, and indeed for the increase in support for independence in Wales. And, you know, sitting behind all of this, it's very, very clear that the Brexit prospectus prioritised the ideology of the sovereignty of the Anglo-British Parliament over the integrity of the United Kingdom itself. This was a deliberate choice. Brexiteers knew the risks. It was much talked about in the EU referendum campaign and chose to ignore them. It's true, of course, that Brexit does complicate the prospectus for Scottish independence, because there is now a risk for an independent Scotland. It'd have to deal with a hard trade border with the rest of the UK. But over the piece, it has cemented the feeling for a lot of folk in Scotland that the UK no longer works in their interests.
You mentioned all parts of the UK there except England. I mean, just to, I suppose, complete the picture, I mean, clearly Brexit, the result was driven arithmetically by a significant English majority. Do you think there's a link between the devolution story for the rest of the UK and then how many people in England voted on this question, with, of course, England not having its own equivalent devolved settlement?
There certainly seems to be some correlation between Euroscepticism and concerns about devolution to Scotland, in particular, a sense that it's not fair on English people, that Scotland gets more than its just deserts. I don't think there is a sort of a direct causality there, that sort of drove people into the Brexit camp or vice versa. But clearly there is a body of opinion in England that believes that the way that the UK has been going, the way that Britain functions these days, is antithetical to their interests. So there are unhappy people in England, as well as in the devolved parts of the UK. And this translates itself, worryingly for those who wish to secure the long-term future of the United Kingdom, into what looks like relative indifference to the future of the UK. So you're absolutely right, Mike, to ask about England, because if we're to work a way forward through all of this, the UK government looking at all of this, it has to think about opinion right the way across the United Kingdom and try and create a settlement, if that's what it wishes to do, that works for everybody.
You mentioned COVID in one of your earlier answers, Philip, and we talk in the paper quite a lot about the sort of trials and tribulations of how the relationships between the different governments has gone and the emergence of fairly divergent approaches to some of the key decisions relating to the pandemic. Just a general question for you about that. I mean, there was a lot of talk, I remember, at the beginning of that crisis about a year ago, about whether this sort of common enemy might actually bring together the different parts of the UK and maybe even bind some of the wounds that Brexit had opened. It doesn't look as if that has happened. I mean, why do you think that is?
This, to my mind, is a bit of a puzzle, because, as you say, it's self-evidently a virus doesn't respect borders, and it was going to impact on all parts of the UK in an undifferentiated way, given the nature of the way that viruses spread. And indeed, in the early days, it looked like it was getting off to a promising start. The devolved governments involved in meetings in the COBRA, in the Cabinet Office, good coordination between the governments, but it began to fray as decisions were made about coming out of the first lockdown. And, you know, part of this undoubtedly was both Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland and Mark Drakeford in Wales seeing a political opportunity to be seen to be taking a grip on the management of this in respect of their devolved responsibilities around health. But at the same time, the UK government, advertently or inadvertently, was opening up that space for them. It sort of allowed them to drift out of the tent. But I think underlying all of this is something a little bit more profound. It's a sort of political reluctance, including on the part of the Prime Minister, to be seen to be working alongside the devolved governments, that somehow it was beneath him to be on the same platform as the First Ministers of Scotland, Wales, and the First Minister and Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland. This was not something that was true of previous Prime Ministers, both David Cameron and Theresa May, through gritted teeth perhaps, but they did go to meetings of the Joint Ministerial Committee in plenary session to sit down with the First Ministers from the devolved governments. But this Prime Minister seems very, very reluctant to do that. And I think the consequence of that has allowed this space to open up. And he's also, his tendency not to be clear when he speaks about whether he's speaking for the whole of the UK or just for England. And that has turned what might have been a unifying occasion into something that now looks very different.
Some of those issues we pick up towards the end of this paper, where we talk about some of the different reforms, some of the different changes that might be made, which address some of the institutional and cultural and political issues that we've covered in this conversation. We haven't got time to go through all of those, but could you just pick out for us, Philip, one or two of what you consider to be the more important proposals that we're coming up with?
Yeah, let me focus on two. I think first off is that we've spoken about a lot, the sort of cultural change in Whitehall. I no doubt in my mind that given the state of the union right now, that all the efforts that have been made over the last few years to get Whitehall to understand devolution need to be accelerated. And the incentives for civil servants need to be a lot sharper to get to understand how devolution operates and how they can contribute to the sustaining of the United Kingdom, if that's seen from the view, of course, of the UK government. That is about ensuring that if you want to get promoted as a civil servant into the senior civil service, for example, you can show that you've got some experience of ideally of government from outside of Whitehall, so that you can bring a sort of broader perspective to bear on the work that you do. I think, you know, for ministers, it needs to be more visible that if they do the right thing in terms of engaging with the devolved governments, that they get plaudits for that. It is seen as a good thing to do, and vice versa. If they don't do it, that they're sort of in the doghouse. But I think the second domain, which we touched on in the review, is this whole question of intergovernmental relations, the format of that. And there's no doubt that it is time now to rethink how intergovernmental relations work. I would argue put them on a more formal basis, not necessarily statutory, but to give them more salience in the workings of the relationship between the governments. But the key thing here is not so much the form, it's the spirit in which the UK government approaches this. And the spirit is so important to get across to people in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland that the UK government is respecting their interests. And that's only going to happen if senior ministers in the UK government demonstrate in what they say and what they do that respect.
We should say that just at the time that we're publishing, the review that's been conducted by Lord Dunlop into the question of how the union is sort of handled and managed in the centre of government, in the heart of government, that has just been published after some delay. And it's interesting to see that a number of his proposals, I think, overlap with some of the ideas that we're developing. So, you know, maybe a more concerted focus on these questions will now come about.
That is possible. And there's been a sort of an immediate response from Michael Gove to Andrew's review, which is broadly speaking accepting the thrust of some of his recommendations. Not, however, one of Andrew's absolutely central recommendations, which is the creation of a post of Secretary of State for the Union. I mean, Andrew arguing that this ought to be made one of the great offices of state. And you can see the rationale for that. This is about the integrity of the United Kingdom, seen from the UK government perspective, that the importance of that objective should merit a very, very senior position in the government, rather than at the moment it's sort of absorbed within the wider responsibilities of Michael Gove himself as Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. I think I would say that what Lord Dunlop is proposing is necessary. The really big and interesting question is it sufficient? Or have we reached a point or passed a point where the union in its current form is sustainable over time? Are they going to have to start thinking more radically about the shape of the governance of the United Kingdom? Really tough, difficult stuff. This can't ignore, of course, the question of England itself as a polity in its own right and devolution within England. But how's all this going to look in 5-10 years' time? What is required to carry that conviction, not just to 50% of people in Scotland, but let's say 65% of people in Scotland, that the union still works for them? Ditto Northern Ireland and Wales. And from the UK government perspective, this must be the biggest political challenge that this government will face, and probably the next one and the one after that as well.
That's a great point on which to conclude this conversation, I think, Philip. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. If you're interested in finding out more about the paper that we've just published with Philip, you can find it on the Bennett Institute website. It's called The Union at the Crossroads. Thank you all for listening. And if you're interested in this and any more of our work, please do subscribe to our newsletter, follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn, and join us for our online events, all of which you can find out about at our website. And please do rate and review the episode. Thank you very much.